Well, I want to welcome you back to the next edition or issue of The Gathering Storm. My name is Dr. Andy Woods. Prior to the passing of Dr. Mal Couch, I was involved with many of these CDs, and it was his desire to see this ministry continue. So I was asked to do a two-part series on the subject of world government, which we started in the last CD that came out last month. And so we're sort of continuing that discussion. One of the major things that the Bible says would happen in the last days is the whole concept of world government. There would be in the last days a government which sits in jurisdiction over the whole earth. It would be centraled in this coming future leader, the Antichrist. And basically what we're doing in these two CDs is we're basically taking a look at that issue from every angle. We're essentially trying to analyze it from three angles. Number one, we took a look at the divine perspective on the whole subject of world government, and we spent some time in Genesis 11 and verses 1 through 9, and that's where we learned the perspective of God, or the Creator, on world government. God hates world government. God is against world government. And the reason is because if only one government exists on planet Earth and it falls into the wrong hands, the potential for evil is unlimited. And so God prevented man's first attempt at world government at the Tower of Babel by confounding the various languages. And then we looked at number two, Satan's goal of instituting world government. It is the goal of Satan in human history to see Babel brought back to life. He wants to rule the world through a man, as he tried to do with Nimrod at the dawn of human history. And we also saw that God, by and large, is interrupting this plan today. But one of these days, God's restraint will be removed. Satan will have his heyday. He will get to do what he wants to do and what he's always wanted to do. He will establish and set up a one-world government. And that is the direction that history is moving in. And that will take place in the events of the tribulation period after the church has been removed from the earth. But even so, we moved into number three. We see that Satan has made many inroads towards the establishment of world government, even in our own day. And what we were looking at are various stage-setting events. I'm sharing with you about 11 stage-setting events, which I think are setting the stage for the coming world government of the future. We spent some time looking at elite thinking, how the elites or the up movers and shakers think. They don't think in terms of nations. They think in terms of globalism. And then we left off last time, as I recall, talking about our educational system, how our educational system, and although there are good people working in it, there is a philosophy at work behind the scenes which is largely training children to be globalists of the future. A related subject, still talking about education, is the whole concept of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is this idea that all cultures are equal. And consequently, you can graduate from our school system today and have a lot more knowledge about other cultures around the world than our own culture. One of the things that's out or despised in a multiculturalist paradigm is the whole issue of American exceptionalism. What do I mean by American exceptionalism? The idea that America is unique, it's prosperous, its founding documents have given more people more freedom politically and economically than any document in the history of mankind. Most people around the world, if you gave them the choice as to where they would live, they would unashamedly and unabashedly choose America, because America has something different or unique or exceptional about it. But we're now in a generation of thinkers largely because of the whole issue of human indoctrination over many generations, where American exceptionalism is so much a dying concept. Even our own president, the chief executive officer, does not believe in American exceptionalism. When he was asked about American exceptionalism, he says this: "I believe in American exceptionalism just as I expect the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism." So America is no different than any other nation on the face of the earth. And in fact, today, if you stand up and you contend for American exceptionalism, you get called a lot of names, such as arrogant, racist, ethnocentric, and so forth. And in this multiculturalist paradigm, one of the things that has been stripped from our memories and our educational system is our rich Judeo-Christian heritage. And in fact, when you study American history, America has been radically blessed, I believe, by God, because we have historically honored Him. Now, Paul Vitz wrote a very important book, and his book is called The Hidden Censors. And he documents in that book that once the Department of Education was established under then Jimmy Carter, what began to be stripped and removed from our textbooks is any reference or any vestige to our Judeo-Christian heritage. And so it's a very important book. It's very important to understand exactly what is happening. Let me restate the title of that book. I think I called it The Hidden Censors, and let me restate the title. The title is actually Censorship, Evidence of Bias in Our Children's Textbooks. I think Hidden Censors is another book, but not the one authored by Paul Vitz. But it's an important book to understand and read because this is something that is happening. In multiculturalism, Western civilization is blamed for most of the world's problems. A multiculturalist, for example, looks at America as the villain, as the aggressor, as the country that has accumulated power through imperialism. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. There probably isn't a country in the face of mankind that has accumulated and acquired more power, but been so benevolent in how that power has been dispersed. It's America that liberated us, for example, from the perils of Saddam Hussein, the perils of Nazi Germany, from Imperial Japan during World War II, and so forth. But American exceptionalism, our Judeo-Christian value system, those are all concepts that are dispensed with under the multiculturalist paradigm. Patriotism, the idea of loyalty to America, is routinely attacked by multicultural educrats. Here's a quote from George Brock Chisholm, who was the first director of the World Health Organization. In a speech at a conference on education in 1954, he says this: "To achieve world government is necessary to remove from the minds of men their individualism, loyalty to family, tradition, national patriotism, and religious dogmas." This is how the multiculturalist thinks. This is the philosophy that our children, if we have them in public schools, are being taught. It is very interesting that globalists do not see children as belonging to parents. They think children belong to them or the community. Just recently, Melissa Harris Perry, an MSNBC host, said this: "We have never invested as much in public education as we should have because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your children, your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. we haven't had a very collective notion of the of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families, and recognize that kids belong to the whole communities. So she's saying children don't belong to parents, children belong to the community, children belong to the educational system. And that is a concept that completely contradicts the scripture. Deuteronomy 6:6-7, going back as early as 1406 BC, says this: "These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons. Shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." Proverbs 22:6, "Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it." Ephesians 6:4, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and in the instruction of the Lord." Joshua 4:19-24, you'll see the same thing. Timothy became a man of God because he was reared from infancy with the knowledge of the scripture taught to him, 2 Timothy 1:5, by his grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice. What does the Bible say? The Bible says that children belong to parents. They don't belong to MSNBC. They don't belong to Obama. They don't belong to the community. They don't belong to Rachel Maddow. They belong to parents. And yet the New World Order thinking is the child belongs to us. We are going to train them to be the globalist child of the future. And as long as children are perceived by the globalist as belonging to parents, that arrangement is viewed as a threat, because those parents are not going to teach the globalist values that they want to inculcate. Those parents and those children are viewed by the globalist as a kingdom within the kingdom that they are seeking to build, and they don't want any competition. Lawrence Krauss, an Arizona State University physics professor, says this regarding teaching creationism to children at home. He says it's mild child abuse. We need to encourage our children to question freely and to think for themselves. Anything we do that counters that is unfair to them. If you're introducing it as reality, if you're telling kids the world is 6,000 years old and they shouldn't believe scientists because there's no way humans are related to other animals, and don't believe any of that stuff you learned in school, or take your kids out of school because they're learning something, then it is like the Taliban at the same level, which is an extreme form of child abuse. The Taliban doesn't want girls to be educated or people to be educated, because if they do, they'll understand the myths that they are learning are garbage. He didn't use the word garbage. He used another word, but since this is a family audience, I decided to put in a proper word rather than a swear word. Anyway, this is how globalists think. Your child belongs to us, not you. And by the way, if you're teaching them this business of Genesis 1 through 11 being literal, that the earth is young and not old, if you're teaching them that evolution is true, that in the minds of Lawrence Krauss is tantamount to child abuse. And not only is it tantamount to child abuse, it is equivalent to terrorist activities, and he likens that activity in this quote to the Taliban. Your child is ours, not yours. There have been many articles written attacking the homeschooling movement. Here's a couple of quotes from people. Here's one from a professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. She writes, "There must be a legal and constitutional limits on the ability of homeschooling parents to teach their children idiosyncratic and illiberal beliefs and values. Government control must be exercised against parents who want to teach against the Enlightenment. Parental control over children's basic education flows from the state rather than vice versa. States delegate power over children's basic education to parents. See, the ultimate authority of a child's education, she is saying, belongs to the government, not the individual parents. Here's another quote from Catherine Ross. She is a professor at George Washington Law School. She writes, "This essay explores the choices many traditional Christian parents, both fundamentalist and evangelical, make to leave public schools in order to teach their children at home, thus in most instances escaping meaningful oversight. Society need not and should not tolerate the inculcation of absolutist views that undermine toleration of differences. If a parent subscribes to an absolutist belief system on the notion that it was handed down by the Creator, that it, like the Ten Commandments, is etched in stone, and that all other systems are wrong, the essential lessons of a civic education often seem deeply challenging and suspect. Such private truths have no place in the public arena, including public schools. Give your child to us," she is saying. "Let us control their thinking. Get them away from your biblical ideas and concepts, and we will create the globalist child for the future." Here is another quote, and this is from Martha Feynman and Karen Worthington in a book called "What is Right for Children?" The risks that parents of private schools unfairly impose hierarchical or oppressive beliefs on their children is magnified by the absence of state oversight or application of any particular educational standards. Public education should be mandatory and universal. What is setting the stage for the coming world government? Our educational system is setting the stage, because our multicultural educational system is currently preparing the global citizen of tomorrow. Kids come out of these schools thinking globally, not nationally, thinking internationally, but not as American patriots, thinking in a humanistic, relativistic manner rather than a biblical manner. And that's just a reality. They telegraphed that they were going to do this and take control of the schools. They've largely done it. And we sit around sort of shocked as to why we're losing the battle for our culture and our country and our Christianity, for that matter. There's another stage-setting event, which I believe is setting the stage for the coming one-world government, and that's a concept called management by crisis. Management by crisis. What is management by crisis? Here's how it works. If you can convince people that there is a crisis, then they will tolerate a surrender of their personal freedoms and resources to a governmental entity that promises to resolve the crisis for them. How did Obamacare get passed? Well, we were told over and over again that there's a healthcare crisis. And we were told about X amount of people that don't have healthcare insurance. And the fact of the matter is, when you look at it, the American healthcare system, as it existed prior to Obamacare, was the envy of the world. In fact, even third world dictators that have universal healthcare, when they themselves ran into a medical problem of their own, they didn't submit themselves to their own universal healthcare of their own country, but they came to America to have their healthcare needs looked over. But if you want to tear down the greatest healthcare system in the world and rebuild it in the image of the post office, which is essentially what Obamacare has done, then you have to convince people over and over again that the healthcare system is falling apart. It has to be scrapped and replaced by something new and better. And so you convince people that there's a crisis, and then people say, well, gee, government, go ahead and come in and fix the crisis for us. The same thing is happening right now with the issue of guns. The left wants to disarm the American people. They want to take away your Second Amendment rights. So what do they focus on? There's a gun crisis. There's a Wild Wild West scenario out there. Anytime a shooting happens, before the corpses given time to even get cold. The liberal media begins to tout that as another example of the gun crisis in America. And the fact of the matter is there is no gun crisis in America. It's interesting that firearms in 2011 were used in 323 murders. And yet hammers, you know, that you use to hammer a nail into a piece of wood, hammers were used in 496 murders in 2011. So if you believe there's a gun crisis, then you also have to believe there's a hammer crisis. If you want to ban guns because there's a gun crisis, then logic would dictate that you also need to ban hammers because there's a hammer crisis. But you see, in order to convince people to give up their freedoms, you have to first convince them of a crisis. Rahm Emanuel, who was, I believe, Secretary of State, formerly under Obama, he's now the mayor of Chicago, and I praise God every day of my life that I don't live in Chicago, since it's the number one murder capital of the world, or one of the top ones. So much for gun control. You see how much gun control helps Chicago. But anyway, Rahm Emanuel says this: you never let a serious crisis go to waste. And what I mean by that is it's an opportunity to do things you could not do before. In other words, we have to seize on these crises, real or imagined, to get the government bigger. Because in the midst of a crisis, real or imagined, people will tolerate a surrender of their personal freedoms and resources. Now, this concept of management by crisis is something that's done at the international level all of the time. The United Nations, probably since around 1990, has been sponsoring a series of conferences, and really the theme of these conferences is the sky is falling. There was the Earth Summit Rio de Janeiro conference in 1992, designed to protect the environment. There was the Human Rights Conference in Vienna in 1993, designed to protect human rights. There was the Population Conference in Cairo, 1994, designed to prevent starvation and poverty. There was the Women's Conference in Beijing in 1995 to protect women's rights. There was the Habitat Conference in Istanbul, 1996, designed to provide global housing for all. And then most recently, there was the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen in the year 2009. And what that conference was designed to do was to implement climate change policy. Now, it's not as if some of these issues aren't legitimate. I mean, we ought to be concerned about women's rights. We ought to be concerned about starvation. We ought to be concerned about things of that nature. But what we have to do is we have to look at these conferences with some degree of discernment. In essence, what is happening is there is a tremendous propensity for exaggeration in these conferences. The threat that supposedly exists is hyped up into something beyond what the facts dictate. And the reason the threat or the crisis is hyped up is because there is an agenda at work. The agenda is really not to solve the crisis. The real ambition is to transfer wealth and sovereignty away from America into global government, because people will tolerate a surrender of their personal freedoms and resources if they believe there is a crisis in existence and the government will resolve the crisis for them. So what is dangled as the carrot with all these crises is one world government. If you have any type of problem at all, one world government is the answer. In fact, I believe the one world government is the crisis. In other words, the crisis is not population growth or starvation or some of these other things, but it is global government. Because once global government exists, our freedoms will rapidly eliminate and deteriorate, and we will become mere serfs, as Hayek said, we will be on the road at that point to serfdom. Take, for example, this issue of global warming. This issue that the Earth is heating up and global government exists to solve the problem for us. Well, with the issue of global warming, there are three issues at stake. Number one, is the Earth really heating up? Number two, is the heating of the Earth catastrophic or is it harmful? And number three, is it caused by man? Now, if you look at those three issues, you discover that none of the global warming alarmists or advocates can give a satisfactory answer. We don't know if the Earth is really heating up. We don't know if it is heating up, if it is catastrophic. And even if it is heating up, we don't even know that man is causing it. It is interesting that we had global warming during the time of the Vikings. And that was long before modern industry and SUVs and things of that nature. I personally am not afraid of the issue of global warming because of Genesis 8:22. God, when he set up the Noahic covenant after the flood, said this. He says, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. In other words, under the Noahic covenant, which was instituted after the flood, the earth would go through normal cycles. There would be seed time and harvest. There would be seasons of cold, seasons of hot. There would be summer and winter. There would be day and there would be night. Even if the earth is heating up, to me, it's not cause for alarm because God has said the earth will go through normal cycles. The Creator designed it this way. And in fact, if you believe in global warming, basically what you believe is that this world that we're in is so defectively manufactured that we as mere humans can upset the normal balance or cycles that are taking place within our solar system and on our Earth. Global warming largely is a hoax, and I believe it's a hoax because of something called ClimateGate, where key thinkers promoting global warming, their emails were hacked, and what was discovered is that there were conversations taking place back and forth between these global warming advocates along the line that we need to distort the data. We need to make it appear as if global warming exists. Why? Because we have an agenda. What is our agenda? Our agenda is we've got to create a crisis. Well, why do we need to create a crisis? Because unless the people understand that there is a crisis, then they won't surrender their economic liberties, political liberties and economic resources to us to resolve the crisis. Google ClimateGate and you'll get a perspective exactly on what I am talking about. The real issue with these global crises is the transfer of wealth and sovereignty away from America into one world government. And once that happens, there will be a radical loss of freedom. You have to understand that our Constitution comes out of a Judeo-Christian value system. We have rights in our Constitution that no other document in human existence provides. We have inalienable rights and checks and balances. Now you look at the United Nations, and this is the group we're supposed to submit to. Does the United Nations come out of a Judeo-Christian value system? Obviously it does not. The United Nations is comprised of Islamic countries who believe in conversion through the sword. They are comprised of Marxist countries that do not believe in free market capitalism. They are comprised of third world countries who are jealous of America's success. And once we transfer our freedoms to that group, a non-Judeo-Christian governing body, our rights will be gone. And what's interesting is you can vote for your congressman, you can vote for your senator, you can vote for your president, you can vote for your member of the city council, but we do not have any votes whatsoever on the direction of the United Nations. So whatever direction they take on our behalf, once we are under their authority, we will not have any control or influence over them. We as Americans are only one of 185 votes in the United Nations General Assembly. That is less than 1% voting power that we have, despite the fact that we pay for roughly 22% or over one-fifth of the United Nations budget. And yet, how do you convince people to go under the United Nations authority? It's called management by crisis. Convince them that there's a crisis, and then they will tolerate a surrender of their personal freedoms and resources to a governmental entity to resolve that crisis for them. And this is done over and over again at the international level. As the United Nations promotes one crisis after the next, and the crisis that they're promoting now is global warming. It's interesting to me that they've changed a little bit of their vocabulary. They no longer call it global warming. They call it climate change. So we can't prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that the Earth is warming or man is causing it. So we'll just create a larger umbrella category called climate change, which would cover global warming, global cooling, hurricanes, and things of that nature. So you have to watch the language. But what they're really looking for is a crisis. Convince people the crisis is real, and then they'll surrender their freedoms and liberties to a government entity to solve the crisis for them. A fourth trend that I believe is setting the stage for the coming one world government is something called the Gaia hypothesis. Gaia hypothesis reads, or can be defined as follows. Earth is not an inanimate object, but a living organism. The Earth is a living, breathing, and thinking entity that we must be respectful to. Or, the Earth itself is going to retaliate against us. The Earth itself is going to punish us. How will the Earth punish us? Through global cooling or global heating? Through earthquakes? Through hurricanes? Through tsunamis? And that's essentially the Gaia hypothesis. Treat Mother Earth nicely, or Mother is going to get angry at us and retaliate against us. Sometimes you hear people use language such as this: the Earth has a fever. Many times they refer to Earth as our mother. So what are they doing here? They are ascribing to the Earth, an inanimate object, a living quality. That is something called pantheism. Paul in Romans 1 and verses 22 and 23 condemns pantheism. He says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of incorruptible man, of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Here Paul condemns people for worshiping the creation rather than the Creator. That's what Gaia hypothesis is promoting. You say, do people actually believe this? Oh, yes, they do. Let me give you a few quotes. Here's an individual named Havel, a Gaia advocate. He says, according to the Gaia hypothesis, we are parts of a greater whole. If we endanger her, she will dispense with us in the interest of a higher value, that is life itself. Here's Lovelock, a Gaia advocate. He says, Gaia is Mother Earth. Gaia is immortal. She is the eternal source of life. She does not need to reproduce herself, as she is immortal. She is certainly the mother of us all, including Jesus. Gaia is not a tolerant mother. She is rigid and inflexible, ruthless in the destruction of whoever transgresses. Her unconscious objective is that of maintaining a world adapted to life. If we men hinder this objective, we will be eliminated without pity. Be nice to our mother, or she will retaliate against us through natural disasters and the like. That's what he's saying. Danny Glover, a famous actor, says this: what happened in Haiti? Now, you recall back in 2010, I believe, there was an earthquake in Haiti. And he says, what happened in Haiti could happen anywhere in the Caribbean, because all these island nations are in peril because of global warming. When we see what we did at the climate summit in Copenhagen, this is the response. This is what happens. You know what I'm saying? Question mark. No, Danny, I don't know what you're saying, because I'm not a pantheist, and you are a pantheist. What he's saying is, because we didn't go along with the globalist global warming agenda in Copenhagen, the Earth, Mother Earth, retaliated against us and caused the Haiti earthquake that killed many, many people. This is the Gaia mentality. How does this relate to globalism? Well, if we should ever buy into this idea, then we will submit to any international organization to monitor our lives on behalf of Gaia. Because all human activity relates to the environment, virtually everything we do can be controlled. Where we work, what we drive, the type of fuel we put in our cars, the hairspray we use, what we eat, all of these activities need to be regulated by an international agency on Gaia's behalf, or else Gaia, Mother Earth, is going to retaliate against us. So Gaia thinking, I believe, is largely setting the stage for the one world government. And that's why I think largely we're moving into what I like to call a police state. The Gaia hypothesis and the issue of terrorism has put us literally into a surveillance society. Think how many times you are on camera every single day. At stoplights, you go into a 7-Eleven, you're on camera. You go into a bank, you're on camera. I would be scared to learn how many times I'm on camera every single day. Not because I'm doing anything wrong, but because somebody's watching me. My behavior and my activities are being regulated. What's pushing all of this? The issue of terrorism, which I believe is a very real issue, but there's a Gaia component in it where our activities need to be monitored on behalf of Mother Earth. And this, of course, is setting the stage for Revelation 13 and verses 16 through 18, which says, he causes all, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, the free and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or forehead, and he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of man, and the number is 666. The Antichrist government of the future will not be a government of freedom, but it will be a government of total socialistic economic control. And Gaia, to my mind, is largely setting the stage for that. Let me take you to a fifth strategic trend, which is setting the stage for one world government. And this has to do with the bewildering number of international treaties and organizations. Let me give you some acronyms. GATT, NAFTA, WTO, NATO, UN, IMF, WSSD, WHO. What do all these different letters represent? You sort of feel like you're eating alphabet soup when you go through all of these different letters, but they represent different international organizations, all regulating us through the auspices of global government. And beyond that, we have the whole subject of international treaties. A treaty is a binding agreement that one country enters into with another. Our founding fathers were very suspicious of such treaties because they required a supermajority Senate confirmation or vote. That's two-thirds of the Senate, or 66 senators, must go along with what the president wants to do. in terms of entering into a treaty with another country. You'll find that spelled out in our Constitution in Article 2, Section 2, and Paragraph 2. Why? Because our founders understood that freedoms would disappear the more we entered into treaties with other nations. In fact, George Washington, you'll recall in his farewell address, warned Americans of entangling alliances. And yet there's a series of treaties that it seems like our president can't wait to sign. But all of these treaties take away freedom in some way. Dick Morris, if you're interested, wrote a whole book about it called Here Come the Black Helicopters. But let me read an excerpt from Phyllis Schlafly, who wrote something in WorldNet Daily back in 2009. I read this because she summarizes well this whole subject of international treaties. She writes, the UN Law of the Sea Treaty, called LOST, has already created the International Seabed Authority, ISA, and given it total regulatory jurisdiction over all the world's oceans and all the riches on the ocean floor. Corrupt foreign dictators dominate LOST's global bureaucracy, and the United States would have the same vote as Cuba. Even worse, LOST gives the ISA power to levy international taxes. The real purpose of the taxing power is to compel the United States to spend billions of private enterprise dollars to mine the ocean floor and then let the ISA bureaucrats transfer our wealth to socialist anti-American nations. Next, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty would prohibit all nuclear explosive testing, thereby allowing our nuclear arsenal to deteriorate until the American people are defenseless against rogue regimes such as Iran and North Korea. Then we have the Kyoto Agreement, would force dramatic reductions in our use of energy, i.e. our standard of living. Then we have the United Nations Treaty on Women, would require us to modify the social and cultural patterns of conduct of men and women, to follow UN dictates about family education, to revise textbooks to conform to feminist ideology in order to ensure the elimination of any stereotypical concept of the roles of men and women, and to set up a federal network of child care facilities. Article 16 would require us to allow women to decide number and spacing of their children. Everyone recognizes this, Schlafly says, as feminist jargon for a UN obligation to allow abortion on demand. She goes on, like all UN treaties, the UN Treaty on Women creates a monitoring commission of so-called experts to ensure compliance. The monitors of the Treaty on Women have already singled out Mother's Day as a stereotype that must be eliminated. From myself, I guess my mother's going to be upset about that since we just commemorated Mother's Day. But Schlafly goes on, the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child is a pet project of the people who believe that the village, i.e. the government or UN experts, should raise children rather than their parents. This treaty would give children rights against their parents and society to express their own views freely in all matters, to receive information of all kinds through media of the child's choice, to use their own language, to receive the right to rest and leisure. I guess, by the way, if you tell your child to go out and mow the lawn, you're violating his treaty rights to rest and leisure. Anyway, she goes on, this treaty even orders our schools to teach respect of the Charter of the United Nations. Every UN treaty would interfere with self-government over some aspect of our lives and would transfer significant power to foreign bureaucrats, many of whom hate America. An updated version of these treaties, as I mentioned before, can be found in Dick Morris's book called Here Come the Black Helicopters. Now, a lot of people say, well, not to worry. Even if our president puts his signature on one of these treaties, it has no legal effect because our Constitution requires a two-thirds supermajority ratification of the treaties. But Dick Morris, in his book, Here Come the Black Helicopters, points out the Vienna Convention. The Vienna Convention is a agreement that we are under. And according to the Vienna Convention, all signed treaties are binding until formally renounced. So let's say our president, President Obama, signs a treaty. And then the majority leader in the House, a Democrat by the name of Harry Reid, I misspoke, he's a majority leader in the Senate, a Democrat by the name of Harry Reid, simply does not introduce the treaty for ratification. That treaty then takes on the effect of law, even though the two-thirds supermajority in the Senate have not gone along with it. Why? Because of the Vienna Convention. The treaty is binding until formally renounced. Once you sign it, it becomes binding. It becomes the law until the Senate formally rejects it. And Harry Reid, what he can do is simply not bring it up for a vote, since he's the majority leader in the Senate. So international treaties and international organizations that we are being pulled into are setting the stage for the coming world government. Another trend that's taking place is the International Criminal Court, which once it reaches 60 nations, I'm not sure they're there yet, but once 60 nations sign on to it, it will have a full operating effect. And this court, the ICC, creates, by and large, universal jurisdiction throughout the world. To prosecute what? To prosecute genocide, to prosecute war crimes, to prosecute crimes against humanity, to prosecute aggression, to prosecute human rights violations, to prosecute economic and environmental infractions, and to prosecute treaty infractions. Now you say, well, this all sounds good. What's wrong with that? Well, notice how vague and overbroad these categories are. I mean, what exactly is a crime against humanity? Virtually any definition can be poured into that very vague language. Lawyers call this language, which is unconstitutional because of its vagueness and overbreadth. Our system of government, our system here in the United States of America, was largely founded on biblical truth. Donald S. Lutz, in a book called The Origins of American Constitutionalism, discovered that the Bible represented 34% of all direct citations from the founding era. The other people the men cited, Montesquieu, Blackstone, and Locke, were heavily affected by the Bible. And so, because the Bible teaches that we are made in the image of God, our Constitution, which draws heavily from the Bible, has in it many rights that we enjoy. But you'll notice that the International Criminal Court, which does not arise from a Judeo-Christian value system, does not have these same basic rights that we take for granted. According to James Herzen in the book, The Coming Collision, Herzen says the following rights are absent from the International Criminal Court. There is no burden of proof on the prosecution to prove its case. There is no presumption of innocence, you know, innocent until proven guilty. There's no right to an impartial jury. You don't have a right to a speedy trial. You don't have a right to an appeal. There's no protection against double jeopardy. Now, in our system, you can't be prosecuted twice for the same crime. But not so with the International Criminal Court. They just keep prosecuting you for the same crime until they win. There's no freedom from self-incrimination. There is no protection against cruel and unusual punishment. And yet, this is the court that many people want to see in universal control throughout the earth. One of the things that I appreciated very much about our former president, George W. Bush, is he would not go along with the International Criminal Court. But now we have a president, Barack Obama, that's very open to the idea. And even if he signs the treaty, despite the fact that there's no supermajority ratification in the Senate, as I mentioned before, under the Vienna Convention, that treaty becomes binding law over the United States of America. We are living in incredible times where we are plummeting into world government. Another trend, I think this takes us to number 7, that I believe is setting the stage for the coming world government, is our own United States Supreme Court. Now, our Constitution promotes limited government. There's only 20 enumerated powers our Congress is allowed to pursue. So if you want to bring people into global government, where government has total control and total power, then you've got to get rid of our current Constitution as a flawed document. So one of the things that's happening amongst legal scholars is people are arguing, A, the Constitution is a living document. Now, folks, if the Constitution is a living document, we don't have a Constitution. If any judge can morph the language of the Constitution into whatever his personal ideology is, then the Constitution doesn't exist anymore, does it? The mind of the judge rules, not the expressed intent of the framers. That no longer rules. And I guarantee you, if you were in probate court and someone in their will bequeathed to you $5 million, I would guarantee you that you would want that will interpreted according to the framers' intent. You would not want that will to be a living document. So we understand that in other areas of law, but in this area of constitutional law, what people are arguing is the Constitution is a living document, and besides that, you can't understand what it says because it's so old. Here's a quote from Ezra Klein. According to staff writer for the Washington Post and MSNBC contributor Ezra Klein, the issue with the Constitution is the text is confusing because it was written more than 100 years ago. And what people believe it says differs from person to person and differs depending on what they want to get done. So the Constitution is a dead document. A, because it's living, and B, because it's unknowable. William Brennan, who formerly was on our Supreme Court, says this: it is arrogant to pretend that from our vantage we can gauge accurately the intent of the framers on application of principle to specific contemporary questions. All too often, sources of potential enlightenment, such as records of the ratification debates, provide sparse or ambiguous evidence of the original intention. And apart from the problematic nature of the sources, our distance of 2 centuries cannot but work as a prism refracting all we perceive. Translation is, we can't understand what the framers wanted. Therefore, the mind of the judge rules the day, not the vision of the framers. And one of the very frightening things to see happening is there's a real trend in the law away from our own history as a people and more towards international sources of law. For example, in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, 1986, there was an anti-sodomy statute, and some folks were upset at that statute, and they tried to get it declared unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, basically said, look, the law is silly in our minds, but there's nothing in our Constitution or in our history which would prohibit such a law. Now, flash forward to the year 2003, where virtually the same set of facts came before the Supreme Court, and this time they struck down the anti-sodomy law. Why? This time they were quoting not our own Constitution and heritage as a people, but rather the European Court of Human Rights and British Parliament and other sources of law. And when you take the Bowers decision and the 2003 decision called Lawrence versus Texas, you see a very clear trend in our system where our jurists are rejecting our Constitution and heritage in exchange for foreign sources of law. And this is pulling us into world government. Robert Bork, who was an originalist prior to his death, wrote a book on this called Coercing Virtue, The Worldwide Rule of Judges. And so this notion that members of our judiciary are going to quote international sources of law rather than our own Constitution when making their decisions, to me, is very scary. because we have rights in our country that are not respected around the world, such as the right to Second Amendment to carry a firearm. That's not respected around the world. Hate crimes are used all over the world to limit speech. Now, fortunately, although times may be changing, we don't have hate crimes in a totally oppressive sense yet in this country. And yet, if our own Supreme Court is going to quote foreign sources of law, then will the Second Amendment be respected? Will the First Amendment be respected? Will we be put under hate crimes laws where you cannot criticize certain things like Islam or homosexuality? And one of the things that's very frightening about our Supreme Court going global is they are life tenured. So what if I don't like a decision they make? What recourse do I have against them at the ballot box? The answer is I have no recourse. It's just tough tacos and too bad for you because they are appointed for life. So our Supreme Court's movement away from our own Constitution towards international sources of law, I believe, is another trend setting the stage for one world government. Well, I didn't quite get done everything that I wanted to get done, so I'm going to go ahead and continue into part three. And I hope you'll join us next time with the Gathering Storm as we wrap up our discussion and our conversation regarding the coming one world government. God bless you.